Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 199, I have the pleasure of being joined by Drs. Sriji Patel and Basil Williams. We discuss the November-December 2019 issue of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician is available in print and online at retinalphysician.com, RETINALPHYSICIAN.com. Remember that this is not a journal club. We're just going to review and discuss some of the articles. And again, thanks to the Retinal Physician team for providing these articles in advance. This issue focuses on new pathways for dry age-related macular degeneration. So we'll discuss some of the drugs that have been successful in phase 2 trials, and which we may hear about in upcoming phase 2 and phase 3 trials in the near future. Remember, a list of financial disclosures is listed in the episode description, and that you can apply for credits for CME from the American Academy of Ophthalmology by clicking on the link in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back with a preview and a review of the November-December issue of Retinal Physician. Once again, you can find Retinal Physician online at www.retinalphysician.com. Joining me for this podcast on an eventful pre-Halloween night, Dr. Sriji Patel from Vanderbilt University. Sriji, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Basil Williams from Cincinnati, Ohio, from Cincinnati Eye Institute. Basil, welcome back.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing? Thanks for having me back.
Good, good. We did one last night, and we were just talking about, if you guys ever watch Around the Horn, we should have, like, you guys should even have, like, a 5 to 10 second thing where you say something. Woody Page always has those signs behind his head on Around the Horn. Anyway, moving forward, it's a very eventful night. We got World Series Game 7, spoiler alert, which is not a spoiler because this won't release till November. The Astros are winning right now. In the bottom of the fifth, we have Joel Embiid getting into fistfights. We'll talk about that later. But we're going to talk a little bit about this issue, which was about new pathways for dry AMD, a very hot topic. And we've got some recent trial data that was announced on Monday of this week as well we'll discuss. So the first article is titled Brimonidine Drug Delivery System for Geographic Atrophy, an implant with potential to slow lesion growth by William Freeman. And again, this is not a journal club type episode. We're just going to discuss kind of points from these articles. He talks a little bit about brimonidine. It's obviously well known as an anti-glaucoma topical drop, but there is some neuroprotective and cytoprotective properties associated with the medication. And so there was this idea to develop a drug delivery system with brimonidine in patients, and it seemed to reduce geographic atrophy progression in phase 2. And so there may be some promise here. So this was the Beacon trial. Basil, just thoughts on it. We're going to kind of go over all these options. Obviously, dry macular degeneration there is a niche to be filled. There is not a good treatment that's been shown to either reverse damage or even slow progression besides the ARED study with ARED vitamins. So what are kind of the challenges with dry AMD studies in terms of interpreting and setting outcomes? I think one of the hardest thing I think would be the trial design is what do you really have to assess in terms of outcomes that may find a significant value for a new drug?
Right. Well, I think there's quite a few things that make the process complicated. First of all, we don't really understand all of the factors that are causing geographic atrophy to develop and progress. And so I think coming up with a good model to use as a sample or as a baseline for these medications to kind of work on in general is going to be a little bit challenging because of that. And then as a result, figuring out the best way to assess whether the medications are either preventing disease from progressing or actually causing the geographic atrophy to regress is a little bit challenging. I don't think we have fully figured all of that out. Now, brimonidine, I think as far as this medication goes, some of the interesting parts about it, so there's a bunch of different mechanisms that are proposed to play a role in this, and I do think that using this kind of biodegradable polymer looks interesting. It seems like it'll be a long-lasting effect, and And in terms of the treatment of dry AMD, one of the most challenging things is going to be injection burden. This is something that we have with wet macular degeneration already. And now, you know, there are some injectables that are either going to be slow release or lasting for a longer period of time. And so I would think that with the amount of people that are affected by dry AMD, in addition to the difficulty of finding something that's actually going to be helpful at slowing down or regress or causing the disease to regress, we would also need something that would be able to last for a long period of time. Otherwise, we're going to have millions of people requiring monthly injections, assuming we're able to find something that's actually helpful.
Yeah, Shiriji, Basil brings up a great point, which would be a good problem to have given we don't have treatment for this, but we already have talked lots about the burden of wet macular degeneration treatment and kind of the goals in extending treatment or ultimately finding a cure for wet AMD. Obviously, it'd be better to have injections for dry AMD than have nothing, but there is kind of a logistical problem with that as well.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and wet AMD tends to have these acute phases, and then we go into, you know, chronic kind of maintenance phases. Dry AMD, you know, for the most part, is a chronic disease. And so really, we're going to be talking about treating these patients, you know, for a very long time. And, you know, it starts early and it, you know, it's going to go on for the rest of the patient's life. And so I agree that we could be going down a road that we actually may not have the infrastructure to handle, you know, putting patients first. Obviously, that is the most important thing, is having something, because right now, you know, we essentially have nothing. It is kind of a precarious situation as we get into these potential treatment options for dry AMD and specifically geographic atrophy.
You know, and these articles all kind of tied together. So other things I've looked at, and there's a general overview written by David Boyer and Phil Rosenfeld titled New Pathways for Dry AMD Treatment, Several Potential Therapies Are in Clinical Trials. And they kind of, again, look at anti-inflammatory conditions, medications and things that inhibit the complement system, things that enhance mitochondria, for example, are mitochondrial protective, and, you know, reduction of quote-unquote toxic byproducts, another thing they talked about. As Basil said, there's also neuroprotective agents, brimonidine, slio neurotrophic factor. These are all kind of the different routes we're attacking this disease condition. And one of the more interesting routes been examined is complement. So it ties into one of the other articles, David Liao with Namrata Saroj, actually is the last author, inhibiting complement C3 and dry AMD. C3 inhibition may be the dark horse for to pursue for treating dry AMD. Kind of talking about the trials that failed in terms of looking at complement inhibition, and that was mostly C5 inhibition, and now they're looking more at C3 inhibition. You know, Shiriji, complement system, something most of us haven't talked about or thought about since early in medical school, maybe. So it's kind of a refresher to kind of go through all this and the different pathways of the complement system. There was a lot of thought and promise a couple years ago about the complement system, and then it kind of died out because lampalizumab didn't pan out in a phase 3 trial. This week, actually, Zymura, which is a trade name for a drug developed by the company Iveric, which was used to be Ophthotech, showed some efficacy in a phase 2 trial, and that's a complement C5 inhibitor. Some people have argued that complement inhibition wasn't given its fair shake in the way the trials were designed back with lampalizumab. What are your thoughts on complement inhibition based on this article and based on what we might see going forward?
So, you know, complement inhibition is very exciting. I was excited about it when the lampalizumab phase 2 results came out. And we see a lot of interesting preclinical data to suggest that there is a significant benefit to controlling the complement cascades, you know, in terms of its anti-inflammatory effects for dry AMD and geographic atrophy. It was a little deflating, I think, for everyone when the phase 3 results came out for lampalizumab, and we really didn't see that reduction that we had seen kind of before. Lampalizumab was a complement factor D inhibitor. Now, as we understand, you know, I think the pathways related to AMD a little bit better, we're kind of going, I think, more upstream. And so, you know, the Apellis trial with their APL2 is a C3 inhibitor. And as the article by, you know, Lau et al. Talks about, C3 is really one of the central components of multiple cascades. And so it really, I'm excited about seeing how these translate into the clinical space. APL2 had really exciting phase 2 results as well. You know, they have their Derby and Oaks trials going on right now. And so it'll be exciting again to see what the results are. I think complement is, as Basil said, this is complex. We're learning more about what causes these changes. And it's a reasonable target given the information that we have right now.
Yeah, really great summary. Again, those for Derby and Oaks, you referenced phase 3 studies, which is critical for approval. That's where lampalizumab didn't kind of get past that phase 3 barrier. But, you have those two. You have this APL2 at the phase 3 stage. Again, Zymora this year passed phase 2. Hopefully will be a phase 3 trial, though some discussion whether the company is going to transfer that to another company as they become more of a gene therapy company than a dry AMD kind of drug development company. Basil, in terms of complement inhibition and then other pathways, the other thing that there's another, again, we talk mitochondrial protection. They talk about the RECLAIM trial for elamipretide. It's a phase 1 trial. It's very early for mitochondrial protection by stealth biotherapeutics. This was written by Priyatha Medhu and Scott Cousins from Duke. Again, mitochondria is not something most of us have thought about in a long, long time. One of the interesting things about way they designed the study was they used this low luminance questionnaire and used it kind of as an outcome measure. How is this important? Again, dry AMD, it's kind of sometimes hard to get visual acuity changes over time or see that. We can look at GA area, and that's been well discussed, but how about this low luminosity kind of measure, both the visual acuity and the questionnaire?
Yeah, so I think this is one of the things that you kind of highlighted at the very beginning when you asked the question about how are we monitoring whether or not these medications are working. So I do think just the concept of how vision is affected in patients with dry AMD is something that's important to discuss, because when you look at visual acuity alone on a Snellen chart, that obviously doesn't capture all of the ways that these patients are being affected. And so, looking at low luminance visual acuity and kind of the questionnaire, I think it's a reasonable way to try and capture some of the visual effects that are happening. I'm not sure that that it has been used enough to say that this is going to be like clearly the best method. But I do think it's a really, really good start. I think also in terms of, looking at mitochondrial work there, this is perhaps something that would allow you to reverse some of the damage. So I also think that this is a potentially promising idea and concept. But I think, we're hitting a theme over and over that each of these papers kind of discuss the mechanisms as to how they could play a role in AMD and geographic atrophy. And so I think they make really good points in terms of how they affect, inflammation or the mitochondria or various things that could be leading to this. But a lot of it is speculation still. And so we'll just kind of have to see over time with these studies how it works out.
And then the last thing was the Barry Cooperman wrote about risdiplam. These medications are going to make me look terrible in terms of my enunciation. And this is a again a medication designed to reduce cellular oxidative stress. It's involved in integrin regulation, and the nice thing here is they have phase 2 clinical trial, good safety profile, no serious adverse events from this drug, which was injected. And again, this is kind of like we talked about, all of these, this is the Illuminate trial, all these medications are kind of just at the doorstep. And I think this is probably the biggest question we all get, Sriji. We can see a lot of patients are dry AMD, and they kind of sometimes ask, they're just, their family's like, why? So why am I coming back in, right? So Why are we doing these visits? Why are we repeating the scans if there's no treatment and my vision is just getting slowly worse? Well, it's because they may be one of the reasons to monitor for wet change, but other reason they may be a candidate for something like this in a couple of years. So how do you talk to your patients and counsel them? How do you keep them optimistic? Because I think this is going to be a really tough disease to deal with, and especially if someone had a family member or a close friend who went through the same process.
Those are great points, Jay. You know, it really, at least kind of where we're targeting things right now, it really is about prevention. And so, you know, these young, it's like you said, young patients who have, you know, maybe some non-central changes and are not having any issue. It's really about convincing them, you know, what the endpoints are. You know, really, we don't know where they're going to go. Plenty of people, the majority of people do fairly well. But if they're starting to develop some signs to suggest geographic atrophy, it, you know, it's kind of that old adage, you know, an ounce of prevention is going to be worth a pound of cure here. You know, we really need to prevent that. And that's what a lot of these medications are targeting. In terms of, you know, keeping these patients that may already have some changes. And, you know, again, it's tough because, like you said, we really don't have anything for them. But right now, it's just an exciting time. You know, a lot of my patients, I tell them, there are a lot of clinical trials going on here. You know, we're starting to engage with companies about various clinical trials. And so I tell them, you know, they're kind of, it's a time where a lot of different treatments are emerging, and especially some people that might be, you know, in their 50s and 60s and having some issues. I tell them that, you know, I feel like in their lifetime, they're going to start seeing potential treatment options here and good ones. And so it's still mercurial, but it's an exciting time for these patients that really had nothing, you know, even up until now.
Yeah, I've had quite a few patients that come in, and either they've experienced a family member who has steadily lost vision and they're very concerned about losing their independence, or they're in the process of dealing with the atrophy progressing. And I think one of the most important things about these visits and having them follow up is that you can offer some level of encouragement. And even if we don't have something solid at the moment, the fact that these trials are ongoing does provide a little bit of excitement for the patients. And so, you know, a lot of times when it's 3-6 months between appointments, a year between appointments, they are continuing to be concerned about what's going on. And so just having them follow up so you can talk to them a little bit about things and the promise of what's to come can be a little bit of a boost emotionally for these patients.
Yeah, and my question for you, Basil, I feel like those are wonderful points by both of you. And I think that the other thing that's interesting from a pharmacologic perspective that's kind of lurking in the background, we talked about the logistical issue of injecting patients. Again, a good problem to have when you don't have treatment for condition. But some of these articles reference that there are companies developing gene therapy along this route. And gene therapy for wet AMD has been described. We have a proven model and now a proven drug that has a long-term kind of, it works for most patients, anti-VEGF for wet AMD. And so if you can insert a gene that makes the retina produce its own anti-VEGF, then that may be quote-unquote a cure or prevent the need for multiple injections. And that's been evaluated separately. But the second issue is now companies are even thinking ahead, even though these drugs are not even down phase three, and they're thinking, well, let's start developing, you know, gene therapy for this complement inhibitor or this mitochondrial protector or this integrin regulator. And that might be, again, a real critical kind of step, learning from the past and maybe bypassing those 10 years of heavy injections, now 15 years now of heavy injections for a very large population of patients. If we can kind of minimize the treatment burden very early on, I think it's really, again, very, very encouraging. These companies are looking hard at gene therapy for these conditions. Right, Basil?
Yeah, so I think that's a phenomenal idea and definitely the way we should be thinking in terms of trying to look forward. So while we still try and iron out the kinks with each of the different approaches to treating this, also thinking about it from the long-term perspective with gene therapy seems to make great sense and would, if we're able to figure out which approach is best or a combination of approaches works well, then being able to navigate around the logistical issues with treatment burden and things like that would also be important. I do think that, you know, one other thing that is potentially interesting and might be a challenge, you know, down the road, you know, looking at the complement inhibitor, the APL2, it did seem to show that with the monthly injections, 21% of people developed wet AMD. With every other month, 9% developed it, compared to only 1.2% in the sham. So I'm not sure what that's going to mean in the long run If, you know, these medications are trying to reduce the risk of dry AMD and geographic atrophy, if that'll potentially play a role in increasing the transformation to wet. And so, you know, there's quite a few things that need to be figured out, obviously, in the process in the meantime. But I definitely agree that looking forward with gene therapy and using any of these methods or a combination of them, when we figure out what's best, going with the gene therapy route would be phenomenal.
Yeah, those are awesome, awesome points. Well, guys, thanks for joining me to discuss these new pathways for dry AMD. Very quick review. And again, if you want to read more about each of those drugs, we didn't go into nitty gritty about the drugs. They're all the articles are there on retinalphysician.com. Really good review kind of going in the next year or two of these studies, and hopefully get positive news for at least one of these drugs and hopefully many of them. So again, like we were talking about with wet AMD in a recent podcast, it's good to have multiple options too, understanding that there's probably going to be some individual variability patient to patient. Srijit, any final words before we break?
No, you know, like Basil said, I'm interested to see what the phase three results show about that. If we're kind of, you know, solving one problem and causing another with the wedding. But it's an exciting time. I tell my patients, you know, be on the lookout. You'll be hearing from me as soon as I hear things. But, you know, there are a lot of potential pathways and there are a lot of potential ways that we can affect something that really is low-hanging fruit in the sense that we have nothing to help patients with right now. So I'm excited to see what comes out of all these efforts.
Guys, thanks for joining us. Predictions for the baseball game, Srijit, on the record?
You know, I'm looking at things right now, and Greinke looks like he's got a real, you know, stronghold on what's going on here. So I have my concerns, but I was concerned yesterday, and then the Nats really pulled it through. So I'm excited, but I'm kind of leaning towards the Stros here.
Basil, I don't follow baseball, so I'm just going to go with the team that's winning right now.
Yeah, as a Yankees fan, I'm going to have to go with the Stros. Since they beat us, I'm going to want to only lose to the team that's going to win the World Series. So
does that really make that big a difference? Like, does that, like, is it, I don't know. Maybe I've been spoiled by having one of my teams win a couple titles, but it doesn't matter, does it? Isn't it worse in a way? It depends how much you dislike them.
You know, I think that no one's going to feel bad for me as a Yankees fan. You know, we haven't won a World Series in a decade, which for us is a really, really long time. And so I'm just figuring out a way to try and make myself feel better. Maybe it doesn't matter who actually wins, but I'll at least think that the only reason we got beat is because we lost to the eventual champions. So.
And then last thoughts, Joel Embiid and Karl Anthony Towns of the Timberwolves got into a fist fight this evening. We saw the video early. I don't know, Srijit, if you've seen it yet. Basil,
I
little
did.
Monologue while Srijit catches up. Joel Embiid?
Well, so I'll say Joel Embiid is obviously a phenomenal player. He's a very interesting and hilarious guy. He's definitely an instigator. And with a team like the 76ers, with how good their defense is and how much he trash talks and how much he gets under your skin, I wasn't quite surprised to see that scenario play out the way it did. I think Karl Anthony Towns is a bit of a competitor, and I don't think that the Timberwolves have been particularly good the last few years, although they started off the season okay this year. So I'm definitely not surprised to see something like that happen.
Yeah.
You know, he apparently, you know, I was looking at the photos, and at one point, Joel Embiid is putting a spell on Karl Anthony Towns' eye. So, you know, you're hoping that no one has to make a trip to your old stomping grounds.
Yeah, well, this covers the basketball games. I wonder which attendee was there. That's a good point. I didn't even think about that.
You always hate to see the old thumb to the eye, you know.
Seriously. And I think Embiid should.
So I asked the legit point, Basil, which was like, why do we... So like Ben Simmons is like on the ground tackling Karl Anthony Towns by holding his neck. He's clearly trying to de-escalate the fight, but in any review of this, he's going to get a monster suspension because he's like choking him. And I was just like, wouldn't it be smarter to restrain your own player? And then you brought up an excellent point, which was...
Oh, well, basically, if you restrain your own player, then you're giving someone from the other team a free shot at your guy. So the worst thing that happens if you hold up the other team is that your teammate gets in a free shot. So
I could not think of a better explanation than that. I think that's exactly what Ben Simmons was thinking.
All Final thing, Basil, how many games do they get for suspensions here?
Ooh, that's a good question. I do think that the 76ers are a team, the NBA.
I'll go first so you can buy some time. But I'm going to say Towns gets 10 games, Embiid gets 5, Simmons gets 3. I don't know who came off the bench, but I think people came off the bench too.
Yeah, honestly, I think that's a really good guesstimate. I also think that the NBA wants Embiid and Simmons playing. So I think 10, 5, and 3 sounds reasonable.
I mean, then
yeah,
the
I think
Wolves,
once you throw a punch.
Oh, yeah, that's bad, right? It's a punch.
Yeah, I think once you throw a punch, that's a bad one. That usually ends up being a pretty high number.
Well, and here's the final question, Basil. Are the Wolves going to miss the playoffs because Karl Anthony Towns got suspended for 10 games?
No, the Wolves are going to miss the playoffs because they're not a good basketball team. Because Wiggins is their second best player, and that's going to be a problem. Although, if they somehow magically figure out a way to, like, get a Chris Paul trade, which I don't think will happen, but if they do, I think they might be able to squeak into, like, an eighth seed. But I think that would even be worse for them. So, no, I don't think they make the playoffs.
Well, guys, thank you for staying up late. I appreciate it. Hopefully I don't care who wins, actually. Hopefully the Astros win, so you guys are right. But have a wonderful night, and I'll talk to you guys soon.
Great. Thanks, Jay.
All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. All 199 episodes, yes, 199 episodes, pinch me, I can't believe it's real, are available on the website, sorted by category. You can also find our blog on the website, and there are links to subscribe via email, as well as in the Android store and Apple store. If you subscribe via email, you'll get new episodes to your inbox as they release each week. You can also directly subscribe in the Android or Apple store on your mobile device. You can contact us on Facebook, we're on Twitter, at Retina Podcast, and you can also email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com or click on the contact us link on our website. Remember that we now have CME credits for select episodes, and actually most of our episodes do qualify, including episodes that you've listened to in the past. You get about a half credit per episode. Good way to listen to these episodes anyway. You can get a year's worth of CME just by going back and looking. We release about 60 episodes a year, so if about 50 qualify, you're getting about 25 CME credits for the year through the American Academy of Ophthalmology. So again, click on the link in the episode description. If you log in, you can claim credits for these episodes. We really appreciate Dr. Sriji Patel and Basil Williams for joining us for this episode. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Benincasa for preparing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis to patient care. You provide articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is releasing on November 4th, 2019, the first podcast episode released on November 2nd, 2016. So this is really our three-year anniversary. We'll talk a little bit about that in episode 200. We don't want to make it super introspective. We do want to provide some content as well that's interesting and useful in that episode. But again, thank you for listening. Thank you for the feedback you provide, the positive reviews you've left. And again, we appreciate all of you, and it made this all a very special experience for the whole team. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.